I'm Karen Handel. I balance Fulton County's budget without raising taxes.
I'm John Ossoff, and I'll work with anyone to do what's right for our country and Georgia.
Because the same unhinged leftists cheering last week's shooting are all backing John Ossoff.
Money doesn't grow on trees. But don't tell that to career politician Karen Handel.
He's a relentless warrior against corruption. John Ossoff.
Honey, I got it. Washington can't handle Handel.
A few of the hundreds of ads being run in the country's most expensive race for a seat in the House of Representatives ever. More than $50 million has been spent on the race. And more of those contributions have come from California than from any other state, including Georgia. And that's because the race between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican Karen Handel is seen as a window into next year's midterms and whether Democrats can gain control of the House. Perhaps key to their victory today, African-American and white female voters. We're joined now by Rose Scott, co-host of Closer Look at NPR member station WABE in Atlanta. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, set the scene for us. Talk about Georgia's 6th congressional district and its demographics.
Well, before we get to that, let me tell you right now, the big story is the weather. And that means big because there's flash flood warning right now in effect. And it includes a lot of the areas of the 6th Congressional District. And if you've lived in Atlanta and you know about flooding and when it rains a lot on Election Day, people tend to stay home.
Yeah.
So that really could be a factor, the weather. But while the candidates will tell you this race really is more about the needs of the 6th Congressional District, as you just said, the outcome will speak volumes to whether or not the President Trump effect, although just 5 months into his presidency, what this means, what the outcome means in terms of is there a trickle-down effect to how people feel about President Trump at the moment.
And this district is what? Mainly white, mainly wealthy, mainly Republican.
Well, yeah, you're looking, this has been Republican country going back to 1979, and you're looking at parts of three counties here. There's Cobb, there's Fulton, and there's Northern DeKalb, and it is upper middle class, very affluent area, middle class as well. I'm not sure race really plays a factor here, but I tell you, women voters could possibly play a factor in this because John Ossoff's campaign, they've been hammering home, you know, what the effect of Karen Handel when she was with the Susan G. Komen Foundation, you know, painting a picture that Handel pretty much turned her back on you know, health and wellness and issues for women. So that could be a factor. But I really think this is more about class and really more about whether or not voters will tie President Trump's just 5 months into his presidency. Will they tie that into who should get this seat?
Right. And so are they both campaigning on Trump's coattails, if you will, either on them or off them?
You know, I think they're trying to stay away from that, although, you know, Karen Handel has used some, connection to President Trump, where John Ossoff has really been sort of focusing on, hey, I am a outsider. You know, he's only 30 years old.
Yeah.
So he's definitely played that I'm not part of the established base. And they've been trying to focus on issues that are important to this 6th Congressional District. And you know, some analysts will tell you that's smart, but at the end of the day, it is down about two parties. It's about two parties here. It's about the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Let's just be honest about that.
Okay, let's. I want to play a bit of an ad from a pro-Trump PAC. They released this ad targeting black voters, trying to get them to not vote for John Ossoff. And this ad has been criticized for taking passages from Barack Obama's memoir, Dreams from My Father, out of context. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Democratic politicians have started coming around again. We normally only see them every other November, swarming around and making promises to get our vote. But nothing ever changes for us, does it? Here's what President Barack Obama had to say about it.
Plantation politics. Black people in the worst jobs, the worst housing, police brutality rampant. But when the so-called black committeemen came around election time, we'd all line up and vote the straight Democratic ticket. Sell our souls for a Christmas turkey.
Talk a little bit about that ad and the reaction to it.
Well, you know, I think here, and you're talking about the South, too, and you're talking about the Atlanta area. Now, I think it's important for your listeners to understand we're talking about the suburbs of Atlanta. Not to say there aren't any African-Americans living out there, because they are. But you have to understand Atlanta is the cradle of the civil rights movement. Obviously, it's the home of Dr. Martin Luther King. And when you get outside of Atlanta, you know, Atlanta has always been pretty much heavily Democratic for the last few years here. So when you get outside of Atlanta, you know, if you're going to try to garner that African-American vote, you're going to have to sort of be a little strategic in doing that. And look, you don't want to just always align African-Americans with the Democratic Party, but that's just the way it's been, particularly here in Atlanta. And I think for a lot of voters, I think they're smart enough, African-American or not, I think they're smart enough to know when a candidate is really reaching to try to get that vote. This is a race this is a contest that comes down to not necessarily about race, but it comes down to class, and it comes down to, do the people in the congressional district, do they feel like one of these candidates will better have their interests? And also, will this candidate align themselves with the practices, the traditional practices of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party? And I think the Democratic Party here in Georgia has come under fire a lot because they've been criticized for not having built a significant bench, particularly after President Obama was elected. And John Ossoff came out of nowhere. So if the Democrats are able to win this seat, it really will be by the luck. It really will be, because no one expected Ossoff to be able to come out. And we look at the votes from the primary. I mean, well, first of all, there were way too many Republicans. There were a lot of Republicans running in the primary. And some analysts say, you know what, that was part of the problem.
Right, so splitting the vote. But in terms of polling, they're neck and neck, correct? Ossoff and Handel?
Absolutely. You know, I've been looking at polls going back to March, and it's been neck and neck. So it should be interesting to see who comes out on top here.
So looking at Ossoff, he's got to turn out the base, right? The base has got to be.
He's got to turn out the base.
And you know what?
Absolutely. And also, I think he has to really pull those women voters. And look, when it comes to issues related to women and our health and our bodies and all that, when it comes to elections, it depends on who that candidate is and how they're able to relay that message. And Karen Handel has come under fire for when she was with the Susan G. Komen Foundation. But at the same time, too, she's had ads where women have come out and said, look, you know, I support Karen Handel and she support. I'm a breast cancer survivor. So she has played that up. Karen Handel has talked about health care issues within her own family. So that could be, an area that she may garner some votes from as well.
Yeah. And so you're referring to with the Susan G. Komen story a couple of years ago when they tried to withhold funding from Planned Parenthood, and that really backfired, and she played a role in that.
Well, she severed those ties with Planned Parenthood, and depending on who you ask, when you talk about abortion, and you and I both know what a lightning rod issue that is, and here in the South, too, that plays an important role for a lot of people when it comes to who they cast a ballot for.
Okay, and so when it comes to the women vote, we're talking about obviously the Democratic base there, but also the swing voters and moderate Republicans, right? And so Ossoff is trying to attract those moderate Republicans. Handel is also trying to attract them or keep them in the tent.
I think that based upon you look at the first 5 months of President Trump's presidency, I think that's a big factor here, whether or not they will come out and say, you know what, look at what the Republican Party has done. They've only been in office 4 or 5 months. That is going to be a rallying cry. You look at Ossoff, he's trying to pull those voters who might be on the fence that might have said, yeah, I did vote for Donald Trump, but I'm not sure based on certain policies and legislation that they're trying to implement under his administration. Ossoff is trying to pull that vote. Karen Handel, on the other hand, is saying, you know, look, we are still trying to right the ship here in a sense. We want to undo all those things that President Obama did. So you need to give us a chance. And she's also focusing on, look, this is a district that I am from. I am of your cloth. I know what you need. I am your, you know, I am your candidate. So it's a sense of, I'm part of your, I'm the fabric of your community, so send me to Washington, versus, you know what, I am an outsider, I'm not part of the established base, and I want to go ahead and lead the change for what's already happening in Washington under President Trump.
Rose, thanks so much.
No problem.
That's Rose Scott. She's co-host of Closer Look on NPR member station WABE in Atlanta. And we want to hear from you. Are you watching the results of Georgia's special election? Did you contribute to either candidate? You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Well, things are heating up here in California, too. Literally, it's going to hit more than 120 degrees in Palm Springs and Death Valley today. 96 in the San Fernando Valley. In Sacramento yesterday, meteorologists from the National Weather Service fried bacon and tried to bake cookies inside a car where it was almost 200 degrees inside. Our neighbors in Phoenix are feeling it too. Planes there are being grounded because of the heat. Well, joining us now, Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot and author of the Ask the Pilot website. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us, Alex Tardy, a meteorologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in San Diego. Hi, Alex.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so where did this heat wave come from?
So the heat wave, it appears, came from when the sun came out and we opened the door to summer. But in reality, this particular heat wave could happen any time of the summer months, meaning like from May all the way through September. This heat wave originated last week out of Mexico. We call it a dome of high pressure, of warm air, and it built northward. It actually reached all the way to Northern California, and as you mentioned, why it got so hot in San Francisco and Sacramento. And right now, we're in kind of the peak of it where it stopped moving, mm-hmm. and it's just sitting right over Southern California and the desert Southwest.
All right. So this last year, 2016, was the third year in a row to set a new record for global average temperatures. So 3 years in a row, 2016, surface temperatures the warmest since modern record keeping began in 1880. A lot of people are thinking this heat wave, a sign of extreme weather, is maybe a sign of climate change.
Well, it sounds like we're making it up, but the stats are staggering. So 2014 is the hottest year on record for California. 15 was second place. 2016, last year, was top 10. And it's not just California. We're seeing records on minimum temperatures, which we don't talk about much, overnight lows, which is a stress on everything, and cooling, and the grid system, and humans. The overnight lows are also increasing. And we're seeing heat waves that are occurring outside of normal summer. So in other words, they're occurring in May, early June. They're occurring in late summer, September, October. Even in February of 2016, that was the warmest February ever in Southern California. So we're seeing these extremes that you mentioned, and the extremes themselves, those can be a sign of climate change and global warming. One particular heat wave, though, like today's, mm-hmm. we can't attribute one particular heat wave to changes.
Patrick, let's bring in you and talk about the airplanes. So some airlines are canceling flights. Why? How does the heat affect how a plane works?
Well, this gets somewhat complicated, but extreme heat can affect planes in different ways. You have first aerodynamic repercussions. Hotter air is less dense than cooler air, so a wing produces less lift, and that's compounded by reduced engine output because jet engines don't like this less dense air either, and that means higher takeoff speeds, longer runway requirements, and so forth. You can kind of say that there are soft limits and hard limits here. The aerodynamic limit is kind of a soft limit. That is, you don't know for sure if a flight can depart off a particular runway at a particular temperature or at what weight until you juggle all the numbers. And then in other cases, there are absolute temperature maximums set by the manufacturer. These can be specific to a particular component on the plane, or it can apply to an airplane outright, say 125 degrees, that's it, you can't fly. Remember, too, that airplanes have a lot of internal machinery that runs hot to begin with, and you start throwing in triple-digit temperatures, here we are. And on top of that, you've got restrictions on ground equipment, all the support equipment that's required to fly, from baggage loaders to external power and so on. And then, of course, the human factor. You've got people out there on a tarmac when it's 120 degrees.
Yeah.
At a certain point, that's just not.
So what's the temperature where they say, you know what, we're just not going to risk this? What's the minimum temperature where they say no planes going off?
No, there is no hard and fast number like that. That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. It really can vary situation to situation, plane to plane. It depends.
But what happens in places like Dubai where it's hot like this all the time?
Well, that's a good point. And to pick up on what the other guest was saying, I think as climate change causes more and more extreme weather events, including more and more extreme heat waves, we're going to see this thing happening, this kind of thing happening more often. And it'll be interesting to look at the Persian Gulf, where you've got the three big Gulf carriers now. Emirates, for example, by some measure, is the biggest airline in the world. And these carriers are situated in what is already one of the hottest regions. And temperatures in the summer there are routinely above 100. And if they start to creep up regularly beyond that, there's a lot these carriers have to lose. And that's true in places like Phoenix and then wherever around the U.S., impacting U.S. carriers as well.
Okay. Alex, the question everyone wants to know, when will this heat wave end?
Well, this particular heat wave, we are at the peak today and tomorrow. Now, right now, as we speak, it's 117 degrees in Palm Springs. It's just noon. Their normal high is reached around 4 or 5 p.m. So they could jeopardize their all-time record high of 123, all-time record high. So after today and tomorrow, it's slowly downhill, but slow is a key word. It's going to remain hot and very hot for most cases all the way through the weekend. Next week is where we might be able to have a sigh of relief and say, whew, got through that heat wave, but not until next week.
Okay. All right. Well,
you can go to the beach. That's always an option.
And stay inside if you're in Palm Springs, for
yes.
Sure. Alex Tardy, meteorologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in San Diego. Patrick Smith, airline pilot and author of Ask the Pilot. That's a website. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We want to hear from you. How have you been trying to beat the heat? You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why there's a booming business in China for so-called mistress dispellers, people paid to break up affairs. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. A man in his 40s walks into a sex shop just outside Shanghai. But he's not there for the reasons you might think. He's there to lay the groundwork for what will become a months-long con to break up the store's owner and her boyfriend. This man is a mistress dispeller who's been paid tens of thousands of dollars by the boyfriend's wife in a desperate attempt to save her marriage. New Yorker staff writer Jiayoung Fan wrote about China's booming business of mistress dispelling in this week's magazine. She says the industry is a symptom of China's rapid economic rise, yet stagnant attitudes towards marriage, and about a woman's social worth. Jiayoung joins us now. Hi.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so what are some of the ways that a mistress dispeller, and by the way, that is an incredible term, what are some of the ways a mistress dispeller goes about dispelling a mistress?
Well, the most salacious method is seducing the mistress.
Ooh.
That's one that's not used terribly often, but it is a way, the quickest I've heard, the most efficient way of getting rid of the mistress. If you are a woman, you might try befriending the mistress and counseling her that this relationship is a dead end. If you are a particularly well-connected mistress dispeller or have vast connections throughout the country, you might try to relocate the mistress to another city. So you can get very creative in this business.
So this is tied into the country's booming wealth. These are rich guys who decide, well, I'm rich now, I can have a mistress.
Yes, it is. Having a mistress in China is, as much as anything else, a status symbol, which is a little weird for us in the West,
mm-hmm.
though maybe not so much, in that having a younger, pretty woman does signify that you have the means of, buying her love and desire. But in China, especially in the last 30 to 40 years, having a fast car, having a young, beautiful mistress, all say to the world that you've made it in a way.
And what about women, wives, or even women who are successful in business? Do they have misters?
I think that there must be a few that do keep someone on the side, but that's much less common. And I think that really speaks to this deep gender inequality in China, in that men just are given much more permission to flander in this way. And for women, it's still, they are, their virtues are seen as loyalty. And, you know, even if it's success, it's a much narrower kind of success. Whereas for men, their success is caught up in both, you know, economic success and this sort of social success that allows them multiple women, sort of like, you know, the Chinese emperors of mm-hmm. old who had hundreds of concubines.
Wow. And, you know, fair to say, this is not uncommon in the West.
Right, right. I think what I learned from writing this story is that, you know, all these notions, going back to this very patriarchal Confucian society, is just exaggerated in China. It's not a completely different thing altogether. It's just taken, I think, to you know, greater levels. So all these, the seeds of sexism, I think, exist very much here in U.S. as well.
Yeah. Well, I think what's also interesting, and maybe you can elaborate on this, is that at least publicly during the Cultural Revolution, Mao said that women were equal. Women hold up half the sky, he said. And so how did that attitude, that official attitude that women were equal to men in terms of work, how did that not trickle down into the private sphere?
Yeah, that's what was really fascinating in writing this story for me. Mao really established communist China under the premise, one of his premises was that women could be equal to men and that communism could usher in this new era of gender equality. And for a time, it was very beneficial for the entire country in that it gave rise to a much larger labor force. But as China became richer, as Deng Xiaoping, Mao's successor, took over and the market economy started really thriving, Deng gave permission to a market economy. The country became richer, but these older traditional values reasserted themselves. So these Confucian ideals of gender roles really, you know, swelled back into the country. And I think what you learn is that it's much easier to write a law than to change people's minds, especially these ideals that have been implanted for thousands of years.
And then talk a little bit about divorce laws, because you might wonder, well, why spend thousands and thousands of dollars hiring a mistress to spell her when you could just divorce your husband, get some kind of alimony and move on?
The crucial thing here is that there is no spousal support in China. So in a country where traditional gender roles still very much persist, where the man is the breadwinner and the woman has been home for decades, divorce is really disastrous for her economically because she has no means of able to support herself when she's single. And in a country which, you know, one of the most remarkable, you know, sayings I heard in China is that, you know, a man is like secondhand property whose value increases, and a woman is like a secondhand car. You know, once she's been driven out of the lot, her value decreases significantly. She has no way of being, she has, you know, very little means of, you know, getting of marrying again and finding a husband who's able to give her the same kind of lifestyle. So divorce is seen as really fatal for a lot of these women.
And how are the mistresses seen?
The mistresses are seen as vile, obviously, from the wives' perspective. But I think they're also stuck in their own predicament. For a lot of young women who were not able to go to universities or top universities, but who are attractive, they see their looks as an asset. And that's a way of earning money and sometimes even supporting their families. I heard a lot of stories about young women who see this as a steady source of income, of not only supporting themselves, but their parents and brothers or sisters.
And they're called little thirds?
Yes, they're called little thirds, which refers to their status as the third person in a relationship or a marriage.
So is there any sense that this power dynamic is shifting as more women enter the workforce in China?
That's an interesting question. I think that's the hope. But the reality is that China is still deeply conservative in its social values. And even now, as more women enter higher education, get master's and PhDs, they are thought, if they are not married by the time they're 30, as leftover women. This really ugly term for women who are thought of as no longer ideal wives and as the bottom of the wastebasket bin. So I think change will inevitably come, but it will be a slow and painful process.
Dayoung Fan, staff writer for The New Yorker, and you can read her article on Chinese mistress dispellers in this week's issue. Dayoung, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, people with a neurological condition that makes them love everyone.
People have no suspicion, no skepticism towards strangers, and they just can't do anything but trust everyone they meet.
How people with Williams syndrome navigate the world, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You could call it being an extreme extrovert. People who are always excited to meet and greet other people, hug strangers, for example, or strike up conversations with anyone and everyone they meet. But taken too far, it's actually a genetic disorder, a disorder called Williams syndrome, sort of like autism, but instead of avoiding others, people with Williams syndrome can't get enough of other people. The story of one child with Williams syndrome is told in a new book. It's called The Boy Who Loved Too Much. Author Jennifer Latson is here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, just in that very brief and superficial description that I just gave, it doesn't sound so terrible being friendly and loving. Tell us more about Williams syndrome and why it is problematic.
Well, your description was great, and that was sort of how it was conveyed to me when I first heard about it back in 2010, and I had the same reaction, which is, why would this be a disorder? This just sounds like an amazing condition. And there are other symptoms of Williams besides the uniquely outgoing personality, so there are some health symptoms that are pretty severe, including a heart problem that can be fatal, and also intellectual disability, and just some things that seem disconnected from this amazing outgoing personality. But even the personality itself can lead to trouble because people have no suspicion, no skepticism towards strangers, and they just can't do anything but trust everyone they meet. And that can obviously be very dangerous when you trust the wrong person.
Yeah. So for several years, you followed a child named Eli and his mom, Gail. And these are not their real names. You are disguising their identities, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like meeting Eli? How old was he?
He was 12 when I met him. And he was so excited to see me. It was like I was some kind of celebrity that had showed up in his house for the first time. And by the end of that day, I'd hugged him more times than I've hugged my grandmother, which may say more about me and my family. But a lot of hugging and a lot of singing. He loves to sing. And that's one of the ways he, I think, interacts with people is singing to them. By the time I was ready to leave his house, I started packing up my bag. And he said, wait, you're leaving? So he really thought, I've made a friend here, and she's at least going to stay over, and maybe she's just going to move in at this point.
Well, what is the basis for their friendliness? Why are they thinking actual feelings of attraction, of love, of warm feelings for this other person? Because usually when we express ourselves that way, it's because we have a genuinely warm feeling for the other person. But if you don't know anything about this other person, where does that warm feeling come from?
Exactly. That's what I wondered as a person who's from New England. It's like, you haven't earned my love, so why would I give it to you? But for them, it really is genuine love. It literally is like falling in love at first sight with everyone they meet. And one of the things that researchers have found is that there's a neurohormone called oxytocin that gets released when, for example, a mother is nursing her newborn baby. And for people with Williams syndrome, this hormone is active all the time. And they found that the baseline level of oxytocin in the Williams brain is about 3 times what it is for the rest of us. So really, it's the same feeling. It's just that it's triggered so much more easily for them. It's triggered almost every time they see a new face.
They also have a marked physical appearance, right? That you can see that they have this disorder. And can you describe that?
Yeah, so their characteristics are described usually as elfin. Originally, actually, when Williams was first identified in the 60s, it was called elfin face syndrome. So their features are, they tend to have upturned noses and a pointy chin and prominent ears, high cheeks. A lot of them have curly hair, actually, even when their parents don't. And so there are some folklorists who think, well, maybe they were actually the models for elves, you know, back hundreds and hundreds of years ago when we didn't have genetics or modern science, and it just seemed like kind of a magical condition.
And are they ever sad?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the extremes of their joy are so high, I feel like they can be more joyful than I've been about almost anything in my life. But there's a point where a lot of people with Williams start to realize, hey, I think of these people as my friends, but no one's inviting me over. You know, I'm not having play dates or sleepovers the way I thought I would. And a lot of adults really deal with depression because of that. And it's a struggle.
But Eli, as you follow him and you follow him to school and to camp and to his birthday party, he seems blissfully unaware that other kids are shunning him.
Yes. And that's sort of the blessing and the curse, at least for Gail. I mean, he really doesn't seem to notice when other kids walk away from him or even laugh at him. But she's so hyper-aware and she's so worried about his dignity and the fact that he's not getting this reciprocal response to his overtures.
Yeah. And so how has this affected her? She's a single mom. The dad took off pretty much when he was diagnosed as a baby and hasn't been a part of his life at all. How does she handle him? Because you describe a life of going from doctor's appointment to therapy appointment, you know, and constantly having to monitor him because she's afraid to leave him alone with anyone.
It's exhausting, and I don't know how she does it, but she does it every day, and she's cheerful. You know, it's not like she's burned out or anything. Part of what the payoff is he's so grateful to her. I mean, he's unlike any other teenage boy that I've met, where he tells her dozens of times a day how much he loves her, and he'll just say, "You're the best mom. You're such a good mom." So that, I think that helps.
Yeah. He is now a teenager, right? Or an older teenager. He's, what, 18?
He just turned 18, and he graduated from high school.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Will he live on his own?
Probably not. So the way his public education works is because he is in a special education program, he's entitled to a few more years of public school services, but he won't be in the regular high school classroom. He'll transition into a life skills program. So that will be his daily place that he goes for the next 3 years. And of course, he'll still live with Gail. And she at this point is thinking he probably will live with her forever. And she has accepted that. But it is hard to know what his life will look like after he finishes with school entirely, and will he be able to find some kind of a job, or how will he find that social connection once he's not in classes with other kids? Because I think that would be really hard for him if he's not seeing new faces or the faces of his friends.
Well, why can't he take care of himself? Aside from being overly friendly, what are the disabilities that he has?
So the intellectual disability on average is similar to Down syndrome. So the average IQ is about in the 50s, and that's where Eli's IQ is. Math is really hard for him. Also, his spatial awareness is really poor, and that's common for Williams syndrome too, just being able to draw a simple picture, or like depth perception can be really tricky, just not knowing, especially for traffic safety. It's really hard to know when a car is near you, and so that can be really dangerous for them. So there are a lot of risks apart from just the social risks, although that's still kind of Gail's foremost worry, is even if he got a job where he was making his own money, the first person who walks up and asks for $100, he's just going to give it to that person because he wants to please everyone. So he can't really be trusted on his own.
And then I assume he's gone through puberty. And so that must also be an interesting challenge for someone with Williams syndrome.
Yeah, I didn't quite anticipate going into it what that would mean. You know, his actions are still the same because he's always wanted to hug everyone, but during kind of the heights of puberty, he was really singling out women and especially curvy women. And so that was like Gail's constant battle was
to hug them.
Yeah, you can't just run up and hug these women. Somebody's going to mace you or punch you. And that was her fear, is that he would grow up, because a child with Williams who hugs you is so adorable. But an adult man who runs up and hugs you, that's not okay. That's assault.
Yeah.
So luckily, as you know, he kind of went through the peak of puberty and then since then has really gotten a lot better. So it hasn't been a problem as much now that he's older.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jennifer Latson about her new book. It's called The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. Now, Williams syndrome is something that has pretty recently been discovered and studied. So I guess researchers are still finding out about it. One of the interesting aspects I thought in your book was that many of these people who have Williams syndrome are gifted musically. Can you describe why that is and how they're gifted musically?
Yeah, and there's kind of two things, because one of the symptoms of Williams syndrome is extremely sensitive hearing. So they have just really good hearing, which means they could hear you whisper from across the room, but they're also really uncomfortable with loud noises, like thunder can be really distressing. And then there's also this tendency to just be really musical. And for some people with Williams, that means they're musically gifted. And some people are savants. Some people have perfect pitch, absolute pitch. Some have been able to pick up an instrument and learn to play it by ear. The way that they are affected by music is so much stronger than for the rest of us. And the emotions that they feel are so profound. Even little kids who don't speak yet or don't understand language yet are so moved by a sad song that they'll burst into tears, and if they hear an upbeat song, they'll be up and dancing. So music is just a really big part of their lives.
He's also really obsessed with the vacuum cleaner
and, yes,
and floor cleaners in general.
Uh-huh.
So it made me think that this sounds like a symptom of autism, but this has nothing to do with autism.
Well, in some ways, there actually is a surprising amount of overlap between Williams and autism, because socially they seem to be opposites. But yeah, this fixation with vacuum cleaners and other machines is very similar to autism. He's also really obsessed with anything that spins. So ceiling fans, if he sees a ceiling fan, he's just enraptured. And so a lot of that is an area of overlap with autism. And there are some people with Williams who have a dual diagnosis of Williams and autism. As far as Eli's fixation with the floor scrubbers, part of that is really auditory. There's some sounds that he just really craves, and one of those sounds is the gurgling drone of a floor scrubber, and he can just listen to YouTube videos of a floor scrubber just on loop for hours.
Wow. He's going to live with his mother for the rest of her life, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, she's older. Does she expect to die before him? And if so, then what becomes of him?
That was a huge part of her concern during the 3 years that I followed them, because she is an only child. He is an only child. The dad is really not in the picture. So who to leave him with, basically, when she is gone was a huge question for her, and one that kept her up at night. And ultimately, she chose a cousin of hers who's very close and who's a little younger, who's kind of grown up with Eli as a sibling almost.
And do all people who have Williams syndrome, do they all end up needing lifelong care, or are some able to take care of themselves?
Some are able to take care of themselves. A lot of them, higher functioning people with Williams, are able to live maybe semi-independently. So some people will live independently but have a caregiver who comes in maybe just for a few hours a day to help with some things that they can't do for themselves. So there is kind of a range of experiences. I met one woman, she's in her 30s now, and she lives in kind of semi-assisted living. So she doesn't have a caregiver in her apartment, but there's one in the building who can help. It's for people with special needs mostly. And so she cooks for herself. You know, she really does the basics of daily living on her own. She has a part-time job. There's just certain things she can't do because of Williams. For one example, she can't drive because of that depth perception issue. She takes the bus to work, but walking is a challenge just because she gets lost so easy because of her spatial perception. So there's just always some element of the Williams disability that comes through, even though her intellectual ability is pretty much normal.
So you came away from this 3 years of reporting on this with what overall thought regarding Williams and just regarding, you know, people with differing abilities or intellectual disabilities?
Well, the thing that was different from what I had expected, I think, is that I had gone into this thinking, gosh, here's a disorder that makes you so vulnerable, and at every turn, these people must get exploited, taken advantage of, abused. And what I was impressed by was the fact that when he encounters people for the first time, most people tend to be really just charmed by him. And you can tell that he's made their day by, you know, he'll run up and compliment you, hug you, invite you over. And a lot of people are really taken by that. And they would say things to Gail like, gosh, he's really a gift. I mean, these are people who, there was a study that found that they don't demonstrate any racial bias, and they're the only group to do this because almost everyone after the age of 3 demonstrates an implicit preference for our own ethnic group. But people with Williams, they think, just don't have that social fear that kind of engenders the biases that the rest of us have. So there's so much that we can learn from them in so many ways that if we could just be a little bit more like them, I think we would be all happier.
Jennifer Latson is a journalist and author of the new book, The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. Coming up, safaris, exclusive wine tasting, wandering, handmaids, all part of this year's insane Emmy campaigns. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 3 words for your consideration. Those words, taking over Los Angeles. The Emmy Awards aren't handed out until September, but we're in the midst of the first voting period. And the campaigns this year are on a scale executives say they have never seen before. Networks are wooing potential voters with lavish dinners and wine safaris. Amazon is setting handmaids loose all over the city. One voter said he hasn't bought any meals at all this spring because he's eating lavish 3-course buffets every night at Emmy events. Here to tell us more about all this is Ryan Bradley, who wrote about it for The New Yorker. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. And Janelle Riley is here. She's Deputy Awards and Features Editor at Variety. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Well, Ryan, this phrase, for your consideration, it's everywhere, FYC. Where did it come from?
It's been around for a long time. It first appeared in January 1948, obviously for an Oscar campaign, in a big multi-page advertisement. Here is the full phrase. RKO respectfully submits the following efforts for your consideration for Academy Award nominations. And then, obviously, things have snowballed since then.
And are they really for our consideration? Because I don't think I'm an Emmy voter.
Yeah, of course not. Here's the complicated thing. I wrote about the proliferation of these four-year consideration billboards a couple years ago. I had recently moved to L.A., I was driving around, and I noticed, FYC. I was like, what is that? And it seems so incredibly wasteful, right? There's only, thousands of Emmy and Oscar voters, yet these billboards are everywhere. Well, it turns out billboards especially are a pretty cheap investment for studios. They don't cost that much, and they seem to work. Voters are reminded of these TV shows and movies. And then also there's the halo effect, right? We all are also reminded of these TV shows.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's also this great sort of grace period before the nominations come out where you get through this campaign, you can kind of put the patina of prestige on shows that might not actually get a nomination. We still think they're in the running.
So, Janelle, how different is this from past seasons? And is Variety seeing a bumper crop of advertisement?
I have been told by people that this is the craziest season they've ever seen and that it actually is outpacing Oscar campaigning in terms of how much money is being spent, which to me is insane because I don't really have figures handy, but I know it's, you know, millions of dollars are spent on Oscar campaigns every year. But I think it's even more apparent with television because there are so many channels. And there's actually, I believe, 21,000 voters to reach out to in this first phase before they narrow it down. And then the nominations are selected by this panel of judges that I'm not even sure who these people are. I've actually never met one.
Maybe they don't exist.
Yeah, I have made that, you know, it could be an urban legend. But I do know right now, you know, when you have so many networks, so many shows, and then so many people who are voting, I've never seen anything like this before.
So 21,000, that's a lot more than for the Oscars, which is around 7,000.
Yeah.
So, and then 450 scripted shows, that's a lot of shows that need some eyeballs, right? And some votes.
I mean, and I watch a lot of TV, and there, I still see these For Your Consideration billboards of shows I've never heard of. And I'm like, how is that even possible?
And Ryan, what are some of the crazier campaigns?
Well, I think, like you mentioned, they're bringing back the Handmaids marching around L.A., appearing, I guess, on buses in buses now. I think the big kind of controversial one is Netflix opened. So in the campaign, the various studios would kind of block out specific calendar dates to host these events. Mm-hmm. And Netflix, being Netflix, sort of just opened its own big space and did some counter programming and set up these huge sets for its various shows, like. For The Crown, placed a bunch of dinnerware on a ceiling and created a whole like mist atmospheric space for Stranger Things. It sounded very, very lavish.
Yeah, and Janelle, I guess the other networks weren't too pleased with that.
I actually wasn't aware of that. I love the Netflix space. I've been to it like 3 times and played with the Demogorgon wall from Stranger Things, and I think it's really creative and interesting. And also, you know, it's so hard this time of year to find places to do Q&As when you have your own space. It really helps. Amazon set up a similar space, actually, at the Hollywood Athletic Club.
How do they know that the people coming to these things and eating this food are actual voters?
That's a great question. I assume it's by invite list.
Uh-huh. And so they have a list of who the voters are?
That would be my guess.
Right. So, Ryan, have you been to any of these?
The spaces? No.
Yeah, or any of these events at all?
I mean, I've been to some in years past. I haven't this year.
So what is it like being courted?
I am not a voter. I think people during that season often just like dine out on this. I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of free meals. A lot of events to go to. There's a very funny game on, not knowing exactly who there are lists that are passed around, but a lot of people that are invited to these, especially the large open spaces, aren't necessarily in a position to vote. The other funny thing about the Emmys is, unlike the Oscars, there's like pretty good economic data on what sort of bump you get from, you know, you can put in this much money and you can expect about a baseline of maybe $10 million back if you win an Oscar, one of the big ones. But but for TV, especially if you're Netflix, I mean, you don't release those numbers. Maybe you have some idea internally, but it really is this black box
of whether or not an Emmy actually leads to increased
viewership. Leads to a significant economic return.
Or whether these campaigns lead to people voting for you.
Right. An even more unknown question.
All right. Ryan Bradley, freelance writer based in LA. You can read his piece on billboard campaigns on our Twitter page, KCRW Press Play. Janelle Riley is Variety's features editor. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with the listener feedback.
Hello there, Madeline Brand. We talked earlier about the crazy heat wave that's going on, and it's nice and cool down here in the basement. It's not affecting us right now.
Because of the air conditioning.
Yes. But I asked listeners how they're dealing with the heat, and Karis Catchings is not impressed. She says Vegas, 120 plus degrees,
And not Mike, impressed that that's not
impressed.
High?
No, or that's like
nothing?
No big deal. Okay. Mike Hinko says he's going to Death Valley. So we've got some tough listeners out there. Yeah. But Jonesy says lots of ice cream and trips to the gym. What's the hottest place you've ever been to, Madeline Brand?
The hottest place I've ever been to? Yeah. Probably Palm Springs.
Yeah. Yeah. I was out there last year and it was 116. Very, very hot. We also talked earlier about Chinese mistress dispellers.
Yes.
And anyone who didn't hear that story must go back and listen to that story because I find it fascinating. But I'm thinking that I kind of smell a business opportunity here, don't you?
For you?
Well, because
it's going to be.
It's not like we don't have mistresses here in LA.
Right.
You know, so there are people out there who might need a mistress dispeller.
So. I sense you're going to be doing some moonlighting. This is what you're hinting at. All right, Christian Bordahl, nascent mistress dispeller. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
I'm Madeline Brand, and thank you for joining us. I'll see you tomorrow.